It's Central Time. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk to an expert about the ongoing spread of zebra mussels in Wisconsin lakes.
First, Governor Scott Walker declared a state of emergency this morning for Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties following the massive thunderstorms that swept through the area this week.
Torrential rains from those storms have caused massive flooding in the area, which have damaged homes and businesses, and high winds and hail were also reported during the storms.
Todd Pritchard joins us now. He's the Public Information Officer for Wisconsin Emergency Management. Todd, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Well, how bad has this area been hit by flooding?
Well, you know, it's pretty devastating. The power of water, I just think, is very evident right now that, you know, communities can be suffering so greatly from a rainstorm that basically parks over the area and puts down, you know, up to 8 inches of rain and you know, in just a matter of hours. So it's really, you know, we're so thankful that no one was injured or we've had no fatalities. This is, you know, a real credit to folks heeding the warnings and making sure that they're trying to stay safe. And really that's our goal right now, is just try to keep people safe and try to mitigate the problems as best we can.
And the governor was out assessing the damage today. What kind of damage are you seeing in these counties?
Well, you know, it's widespread. And the problem with water is that, you know, you can see where all the water is, but you can't see what's under the water and the damage that's left until it recedes. So it's going to take a while before we really get a handle on exactly, you know, dollar estimates and how many homes and businesses were hit. But, you know, just by the sheer size of the roads that were affected and closed, that's going to be, I'm sure, in the millions of dollars to repair and businesses, homes, you know, widespread damage, especially in the town and city of Burlington. They really, as the governor saw today, were so hard hit there. And the bulk of a lot of our efforts and the National Guard today is to try to keep people safe and see if we can get things back to normal there.
Burlington also has a tourism economy. There are vineyards there, apple orchards in the area. Do we know anything about how businesses are faring after this?
You know, we don't know. Obviously, a lot of businesses, just transportation around the area is difficult at this point, and that will, you know, subside hopefully in the next few days. But, for you know, in the short term here, it's going to be difficult to get from point A to point B. So a lot of businesses are affected. But I think the good news is that, you know, we can, at Wisconsin Emergency Management, we can help, you know, get roads back up and running. They might not be, you know, 100%, but we can get them serviceable fairly quickly. And obviously the road crews of the different counties can get things done fast and be able to not miss out on a lot of tourism. But yeah, for the next few days, it's going to be difficult to get from point A to point B.
We're talking right now with Todd Pritchard. He's Public Information Officer for Wisconsin Emergency Management. We're talking about the extensive flooding damage that's been hard hit in Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties. Governor Walker in Burlington today. Todd, they were saying on the Burlington website to take the Burlington bypass to get around the area. Tell us what that is and how people are getting around.
Well, they're one of the main roads in town is blocked off, so it is difficult to get around. There's detours that are, you know, guiding people around there. But there are some folks that, you know, we talked to today that literally because of the bridges, and you mentioned it in your report just a few minutes ago, the bridges across the Fox River are blocked right now. There's one that's open to some pedestrian traffic and some emergency vehicles, but to general traffic, they're not open. And so there are some people who cannot get to, you know, their homes. They're kind of forced to be out of their homes for a while until the water subsides and those bridges are safe again to go on. So it's going to take a lot of patience from folks to kind of get through the next day or two. But the good news is that the river has crested in Burlington. It's also crested, should be cresting right now in New Munster. So as we go through the weekend, it's going to slowly subside and, you know, keep our fingers crossed. We won't have any increase. Obviously, we'll keep on the downside here and be able to open those roads and be able to get, you know, more transportation going.
Is there still a robust sandbagging operation going on?
Yeah, the Department of Corrections did have a strike team out there of inmates that were helping out, which was great. And, of course, a lot of volunteers showed up to help sandbag, which is awesome. And so there are some efforts that crew from the corrections is still on scene. They're going to be there until 9 o'clock tonight. But for the most part, it's, you know, they've got the sandbags in place. They may need to put a few more in Burlington. Obviously, downstream, we're concerned and watching to see what activity goes on down there and what we need to react to down as you go south. But yeah, the sandbagging it's been a full scale effort to try to protect as much property as possible.
Do we know what assistance the cities that are affected, what they're asking for?
Everyone has some different needs right now, and you know, a lot of the, especially in the, you know, town and city of Burlington, it's we've been helping along with the National Guard to get some guardsmen there to help with traffic control. As you mentioned in your report a few minutes ago, they're also doing some welfare checks. They're going from door to door, sometimes by boat, to, you know, make sure that people are okay. They're either out of their house, or if they're still in their house, that they're doing okay, and if they need any assistance. We had some evacuations yesterday at a trailer home park, but so far everyone else has been able to get out on their own. So they're just, you know, doing some double checking today to make sure everyone is safe. And I think that's really the key. You know, in these kind of situations, local resources get tapped very quickly. Obviously, law enforcement, first responders are doing a great job, and but in these kind of circumstances, they really need some help. So that's where the Guard help is been really awesome, and helping them deal with that. Also, there's been some response from other counties in the area sending up first responders, fire, police, state patrol has reacted. So, you know, it shows that, you know, Wisconsin is such a great state. You know, we all work together. When there's a crisis, we all pull together and try to, you know, help everyone out. And that's exactly what's going on right now.
It's really early on, but is there any sense how costly this flooding will be for this region?
No, and that's a great question. It's going to take a while before we really get a handle on that. And like I mentioned before, it's a matter of just letting the water kind of subside and then really seeing what's going on. For homeowners, obviously, it's a painful experience. You know, one thing that I think is important for homeowners to realize is to document the damage that they have, take lots of pictures. Call your insurance company to see what's covered and what's not. And then one thing that really kind of throws people off sometimes is, you know, if you've got water in your basement, making sure you don't pump it out too quickly. In past flooding episodes, we've seen where when you drain the water out quickly, it kind of changes the pressure, and all of a sudden you start getting cracks or even potential collapse of walls of your basement. So it's smart to do, you know, try to be safe and smart and do it slowly, so you're not running the risk of that kind of additional damage to what's already been occurring.
And Todd, as we wrap up, what is the power situation like there? Where is the power on? Where is it off? What can we expect with that?
That's been a huge concern. We Energies just reported to us a little while ago that they are bringing in some temporary transformers. A lot of the transformers and control units that regulate the power in Burlington were flooded, shorted out, and so they're bringing in some temporary transformers. They hope to have power restored hopefully by tomorrow. That's always such an ordeal, and I really feel for folks that don't have power. It's like suddenly going back to the 19th century, and you really feel helpless to do anything about it. But The good news is that they've got some fresh equipment coming in. There are also some generators that were sent in and available overnight to help, especially at the water pumping station and some other key infrastructure that needed power. So residential power should be back, hopefully by this time, certainly tomorrow.
Todd, thanks for your time.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much.
Todd Pritchard is the Public Information Officer for Wisconsin Emergency Management. He joined us to talk about the extensive flooding damage in Racine, Kenosha, and Walworth counties. Governor Walker declared a state of emergency this morning.
Zebra mussels have been quickly spreading throughout our state's lakes, and the problem only seems to be getting worse. Our next guest calls them the most successful invasive species on the planet.
Jake van der Zanden joins us. He's a professor at the UW Center for Limnology. Jake, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us, what are zebra mussels and what do they look like?
Okay, well, zebra mussels is essentially a small clam, and they're much smaller than any other clams you would normally see here in Wisconsin. They're about the size of your fingernail or a little bit smaller. And this is a species that lives on the bottom, so you're not going to see it up in the water column. They're always on the bottom on some sort of hard surface.
And why zebra? Do they have stripes?
They do have little stripes on them as well. So that's why they're called the zebra mussel. Yeah.
And how do they affect our lakes?
Okay, well, zebra mussels are a species that's been spreading into a lot of new lakes. And they are unusual in their ability to just transform the ecology of a lake. And I can sort of describe that. Essentially, the first thing they do is one of the main ways they affect lakes is they filter the water. And so they're clearing the water over the course of eating. At the same time, they also excrete a lot of nutrients in the process of doing that. And so what we end up getting is a situation where the water in the lake is clearer, and then they're oozing a lot of nutrients. And what that does is it allows more light to go to the bottom. And with all those nutrients down there, we get these big, gooey mats of algae growing on the bottom. And so someone might look at the lake and say, oh, it's more clear. But down below, there's lurking these gooey, scummy mats. And then those mats ultimately get washed up onto shore and cause a stinky mess.
And what about fish? What do fish think of them?
Well, anytime a species comes in and transforms the system, there are winners and losers. So some fish that can feed on the bottom and can feed on zebra mussels are going to benefit from them. And there
like
are
a
some bottom
carp, maybe?
Yeah, carp and some other bottom feeding fish do benefit, but many of our native fish species here in Wisconsin do not benefit from it because they feed more up in the water column, and so they are the losers in this game. The other thing that's notable to mention is that there is a fish species that comes from the same lake in Central Asia as the zebra mussel comes from. It's called the round goby. And the round goby evolved feeding on zebra mussels. It's an invasive species here now, and so it shows up and it does really well because its favorite food, a buffet of zebra mussels, is here.
So two invasive species here, and the predator would be this fish, but you don't want more invasive things in the lake?
Well, we don't want them coming, but they come, and they do really well because the zebra mussels are here. So you could think about it like the ecosystem of the Caspian Sea in Central Asia is starting to reassemble here in North America, and that's not really what we want. So, yeah.
Are there other natural predators of these zebra mussels?
None that are effective at knocking down the populations in a substantial way, but there are a lot of species that will eat. Well, remember, the zebra mussel, it's a clam, and so it's got this very hard shell. So most organisms in this part of the world are not adapted to feeding on it in the shell. And, you know, it would be like if you were to go eat some mussels, but you had to eat the shell. You know, we can crack them open
with
our hands.
Not very appetizing.
No, it's not super appetizing.
We're talking right now with Jake van der Zanden. He is a professor at the UW Center for Limnology. We're talking about zebra mussels that have made their way, an invasive species, made their way into inland lakes here in Wisconsin, many other states as well. Jake, do people need to take any special precautions in infested lakes?
Yeah, absolutely. They're currently in several hundred water bodies in Wisconsin right now. In addition, they're in Lake Michigan and Lake Superior. The thing that people can do is make sure they're not spreading zebra mussels around to new water bodies. That's really the first line of control in dealing with this this issue. And zebra mussels can be spread either as the adult, so that fingernail-sized thing that you'll actually see that on your on a rock or on your boat if it's attached. But there are also these microscopic larvae. And you will not see them, but they are there in really high levels in summer in water. So if you were to transport water from, say, Lake Mendota into some other lake, you could inadvertently spread zebra mussels, and you wouldn't even know you did it. And so this is something that's really important, just to make sure we're cleaning off our boats and not moving water and other sorts of materials from one lake to another.
And when we go swimming in these lakes, I've heard they're kind of sharp on our feet.
Yeah, that's one of the main impacts. There are many. One is that they have these sharp shells. And so if you swim, a lot of people have been complaining about cutting their feet on the shells of zebra mussels. And the other big economic impact is that they will grow on water intakes of industrial users and utilities. And so when zebra mussels show up, then the local utility spends millions of dollars trying to unencrust all of these shells from the intakes.
Oh, because so they're clogging the intakes.
They clog the intakes, and so now they're constantly having to clean them. When I say the species is really prolific and they become really abundant, I mean it.
Wow.
Yeah.
So apparently zebra mussels are in less than 2% of Minnesota lakes. Why are they so prevalent just one state over here in Wisconsin?
Well, they're not necessarily less prevalent. We have about 15,000 lakes here in Wisconsin, and they're in a couple hundred.
Okay.
So it's in the same ballpark.
It's in the same ballpark.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing is that there are some lakes that just simply are not very suitable for zebra mussel. Those are those really crystal clear, unproductive, pure lakes. They don't have enough calcium in the water to support zebra mussels. And Minnesota does have more of those kinds of lakes than we do in Wisconsin. But no, it's, you know, I would say it's similar.
Speaking of Minnesota, they're experimenting with a special copper-based pesticide that's being applied to parts of Lake Minnetonka, and it's supposed to reduce the survival of larvae. What do we know about this product?
I am skeptical about a lot of these sorts of technologies that are supposed to get rid of zebra mussels. We look at many of the lakes that we have invaded here in Wisconsin, and they're really large water bodies. Lake Mendota, it's massive. There's billions of gallons of water out there, and there's really nothing that we could do to eliminate zebra mussels that would have no impacts on the other species. So there's a lot of research going on right now to try to figure out ways of controlling these, but those types of techniques are only really applicable at very small scales. Like, let's say there is a water intake. Perhaps you could use those sorts of technologies at that very local level, but for a real ecosystem, it's really not viable.
You're not going to spray an entire lake or dump something into an entire lake.
I would not advise it. I mean, what else are you going to kill, right?
What is some of the other research going on to try to control zebra mussels? Because I understand you can't eradicate them.
Yeah, so eradication, which would involve just getting rid of them, is not an option. But there are some things that we may be able to do to keep their populations level down. I sort of view the invasion of Lake Mendota as an opportunity to maybe learn some of these vulnerabilities. So Lake Mendota is one of the most well-studied lakes in the world, and maybe we could sort of figure out what are the factors that might keep their populations down. So, yeah, they're still going to be there, but you take the edge off of their impacts.
Let's take a call now about zebra mussels. Kenneth in Janesville. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. Have raccoons, native raccoons, discovered the escargot? I mean, zebra mussels?
That is a great question. I think that they probably have, and I haven't really done a lot of research on raccoons, but it seems to make sense that they would have tapped into them. The flip side of that, though, is that raccoons are really small, and there's not a lot of, zebra mussels. Raccoons are not really small. Zebra mussels are really small, and there's not a lot of meat on a zebra mussel, and you have to get through all of those shells. But I think a really hungry raccoon might enjoy some of these zebra mussels.
Who knows? Yeah. Well, so we have cold winters. There are some nuisance aquatic plants that get killed off during cold winters. What happens to zebra mussels during the winter?
They survive winters just fine.
You're kidding.
No,
huh.
You don't see a lot of zebra mussels in the very shallow water environments of lakes. And that's for two reasons. One is that the water level will sometimes be drawn down in lakes if there's a water control structure, and so they'll get dried down. The other thing is that the wave action, but particularly the ice action in those really shallow waters, will kill off the zebra mussels. So you might go down to your lake and look in the water, and you don't see any in that really shallow water. You go out a meter to where the water is a few feet deep, and you start picking up rocks, and you'll see lots of zebra mussels out there. So, you know, the deeper water is more of a refuge from the ice.
So are we getting any sense of how we may be able to reduce them? And are we concerned about zebra mussels? I mean, should we be taking notice here?
Well, they do have major ecological and economic impacts, so we should be concerned about them. I think the efforts that the state has taken and citizens have taken has been to try to stop them from spreading further, and I think those efforts have been successful. So that's, I would say, the main thing that we can do. And of course, there is research going on with regard to, you know, how we might actually control them. But again, I think really implementing those is somewhere down the road at this point.
And are there resources available to find out more information? So how we can, you know, study up on what we can do to help?
Sure. The DNR, the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, has a website that has a lot of really useful information about the ecology of zebra mussels. My lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Center for Limnology also has a web page about invasive species, and we have some basic information about the ecology of these species. So those would be things to check out for sure.
And when did they arrive on the scene here in Wisconsin?
Well, they moved into inland lakes of Wisconsin in the 1990s.
Okay.
So they have been spreading around here for a while, and they've spread pretty quickly too. So they're not new members of our state.
Well, we have an eye on them now.
Yeah.
Well, Jake, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
That was Jake Van Der Zanden. He's a professor at the UW Center for Limnology, and we've been talking about the spread of zebra mussels in Wisconsin lakes.
Coming up after the news, it may look like the U.S. is in the midst of a major ideological divide, but our guest says most people aren't on either side. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
Politics in the United States have been pretty divided in recent years. That's no secret. People are divided sharply along party lines, and it can look like there's a big divide on ideological lines, too, with people lining up on the left and the right with not much room for middle ground.
Our next guest says things are more complicated. When we look at the American public as a whole, most people don't fit political labels like liberal and conservative or left and right, but that doesn't mean they're moderates either.
Nathan Calmo joins us now, formerly of Wisconsin. He's now an assistant professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. He's co-author with Donald Kinder of the new book, Neither Liberal Nor Conservative, Ideological Innocence in the American Public. Nathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, from where I'm sitting, Nathan, this is really interesting because when you hear people who call in to political talk shows and when you do the job I do, you read a lot of people expressing ideological political opinions. It looks like everybody's on one side or the other. What do things look like, though, when we start to look at the public at large?
A lot of those perceptions are a little bit misleading when you think about the people who are writing letters to the editor, who are the commentating class, people who call into radio shows, much of your audience, I'm sure. There is a higher level of political sophistication that starts to look a little bit more like ideology in the public. But if you look at the public as a whole, most of the public really doesn't have this kind of way of structuring their political attitudes, of using ideological labels like liberal and conservative to guide their choices about issue attitudes or about who they're going to vote for.
We've been surveying people for a long time on these questions of how do you identify politically. What have we learned over the last bunch of decades?
Yeah, so the survey research field really kicked off in the 1940s and the 1950s, and one of the first interesting findings was this idea that the public as a whole does not tend to resemble political leadership, political elites in how they think about politics. And that's an assumption that many people make, but doesn't really get borne out in the survey data. Part of what we're doing in our book is trying to update that. We have a lot of changes in the last several decades of a new media environment with the internet and also the return of partisan media. We have a public that's much more educated than it was back in the 1950s and the 1960s. We have political parties that are much more polarized at the leadership level than we had back then. And yet, despite all of these changes, we see quite similar results. In other words, that people's issue attitudes tend to be not particularly coherent. They tend to be unstable over time. About half of the public doesn't even use ideological labels to describe themselves, and those that do, it's only the most knowledgeable of them where that ideological label has any force in the choices that they're making.
Right, because in the surveys, as you read about in the book, a lot of times a person might say, yeah, I'm a conservative, or yeah, I'm a liberal, but when they go issue by issue, they're maybe exactly the opposite or a mix of what people would consider liberal or conservative. Is that right?
That's right. They can be all over the map, even among people who do use those ideological labels. One of the big conclusions that we have is that there's a major stratifying of the public, where there's a top group of maybe 10 or 20% of the public that is quite engaged in political affairs. They follow the news closely, and they're very knowledgeable about politics. And for that group, they really do look more ideological, like leaders. But for most of the public, they don't have that kind of way of seeing the world. We actually see ideology as a benefit rather than a negative, because it helps people organize the political world and to make sense of it. And it's only that upper strata that has that sort of lens to make sense of the political world. The rest of the folks tend to be all over the map in terms of their political attitudes. Some of them are moderate, some of them kind of bounce back and forth, regardless of their labels. But if they don't have that higher level of sophistication, they're not really making sense of those terms.
But maybe let me make the opposite case. Maybe people just kind of straitjacket themselves by saying, I'm a conservative, liberal, libertarian, socialist, or whatever. Maybe it's better to be outside of those labels, take one issue at a time as it comes, and one candidate at a time. Maybe those people are better voters or citizens.
Yeah, that's an interesting argument. It's certainly the case that you can have a knowledgeable citizen or a knowledgeable leader approach politics on an issue-by-issue basis. It's a lot harder to approach politics in those ways that aren't as organized by sort of higher-order principles. The kind of argument that you're suggesting also has a parallel in terms of partisanship, that the thinking that I don't want to be locked into the Republican Party or the Democratic Party or maybe a third party. I want to just think of myself as a political independent. And what we find is that, at least on average, people who call themselves ideological moderates or who don't even place themselves on the scale at all, and likewise people who call themselves political independents, actually tend to be lower in political knowledge, lower in interest in politics, lower in attending to news, and lower in political participation. And so, although there might be some exceptions of people who are sort of that idealized citizen of uncommitted but still engaged in politics, on average in the survey research, we don't find that on average.
We're talking to Nathan Calmo. He's co-author of the new book, Neither Liberal Nor Conservative. It says that most of us in the United States aren't ideological. We don't come in with a set of principles that we use to weigh issues or candidates or political parties. But that doesn't mean, Nathan, that we don't have ways of relating to politics. You talk about group affiliation. There's an identity that factors into how we relate with politics that may be more important for people than ideology. Can you talk us through that?
Sure. In the absence of ideology for most people, instead, maybe not surprisingly, the predominant force is a partisan identity. But the link between that partisan identity and the substance of issues is often not there. Again, that tends to be moderated by political knowledge that that a Republican is not necessarily conservative in their views consistently. A Democrat is not consistently liberal, unlike the leadership class. And so you have an identity rooted in partisanship that's sort of substance-free in a way. So you still have the us versus them animosities and certainly have the behavioral commitments to your team when it comes to be election time or when somebody is bad-mouthing your party. You might stand up and say something about it. So you still have that us versus them mentality, but you don't, for most people, you don't have that rooted in a substance that's grounded in principles or issue attitudes. In concert with partisanship, you also have social identities and social group attitudes, how you think about the prominent groups in society, unions, people of color, big business, those kinds of groups, and that you can, if you are paying attention enough to be able to see the connections between a policy and those groups, you're going to want to support policies that help groups you like and support policies that hurt groups that you dislike. And those social identities can also layer into your partisan identities.
So once we pick our team, it's like being a Packer or New Orleans Saints fan. We're going to support them, and we're not really going to worry about the nuances of ideology. Is that right?
That's right. And I should just add as a side note, I am still a loyal Packer fan.
Well, I would hope so.
I haven't converted to the Saints here. That's the gist, is that you have, again, a top strata of the public that is going to be closely following the lead of partisan leaders. And for the most knowledgeable set of citizens, they will be more likely to express the same ideological principles, the same labels, and the same issue positions as leaders in their party. But as you start to get further down into the public, that same kind of connection doesn't hold, and so it sort of gets lost along the way.
And I want to translate this into recent election terms, and I saw a review of your book that gave this example. Donald Trump, as a candidate, a lot of Republican leaders, intellectuals in the conservative movement said, our voters, our Republican voters, are going to reject this guy. He is off the charts. He's not really conservative on issues like trade, government spending, immigration, and more. And yet, here we are. Clearly, a lot of Republican voters embraced Donald Trump. So how does that fit into what you've laid out in your book?
I think it fits pretty well, both on the Republican and the Democratic side. If we had voters, and especially strong partisans who were engaged in the nomination process, who were strong ideologues, then you would expect that maybe the nominees would have been Ted Cruz on the Republican side and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side. But instead, you saw the partisan voters on each side choose a relatively more moderate candidate, at least in terms of their expressed preferences relative to the other candidates who are in the race. It does fit very well once you get to the general election with the idea that voters aren't attuned. Not only are they not attuned to ideological cues from the candidates, instead they're attuned to party cues about who's got the D next to their name or the R next to their name when it comes to the ballot box. But they're not even attuned to some of the broader traits of the candidates. And for as unusual as the 2016 campaign and election looked, voters responded as if this was a generic Democrat and a generic Republican when we look at their actual electoral behavior.
Nathan Calmo is with us, co-author of the new book, Neither Liberal Nor Conservative, Ideological Innocence in the American Public. He says most Americans don't really define themselves by a political ideology, even though it may look like there's a major ideological divide in the country.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you define yourself as a liberal or as a conservative or a socialist or a libertarian or a moderate? If so, what does that label mean to you? If you're none of the above, how do you decide whom to vote for and what stance to take on issues? Do you identify strongly with a political party? Call 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time.
Nathan Kelmo is with us from Louisiana State University, talking about his new book, Neither Liberal Nor Conservative. He and his co-author say most Americans don't really fit into the liberal, conservative, and left-right spectrum of politics.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you fit into the left-right liberal conservative labels, or do you have some views that are considered conservative, others that are liberal? How do you define yourself politically, if at all? How do you make your decisions on a candidate, on an issue? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Brittany starts us off in Madison. Brittany, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm pretty young. I'm 24, and I didn't have politics my whole life. But to me, it seems like the country is very divided, and I was curious if it's always felt like this and maybe where it's going. Are we going towards more of a divide, or will it always like this?
Brittany, thanks for the call. And the divide I think she's pointing toward is the partisan divide, which is definitely pretty strong, I think, Nathan, it's fair to say.
That's right. And we see that both among political leaders. If you look at Congress, the amount of polarization in terms of the voting patterns that you see in Congress, that is higher than it has ever been in our history. You also see that in the animosity expressed by ordinary Democrats and Republicans towards each other. We've tracked over several decades the increasing negativity that partisans express towards the other side, and that's been growing over these years. And in contrast, when we ask people, how do you feel about the other ideological label, we actually don't see a trend like that. So that's another piece of information that we found that suggests that the growing divide, and in particular the growing animosity, is with the party identities and not with a deeper ideological difference.
Brittany, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Mark with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Hey, I think that this whole divide thing is so shallow and so non-representative what the actual population is, and your survey is showing, look, the population's a heck of a lot more complex than what the media keeps trying to shove down our throats. And I think it's a disservice and a disrespect to the human population to only talk as though there is this shallow left-right possibility and nothing else. The population is a heck of a lot more complex than that, but the media sure as heck is not.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. Nathan, to the first part of his point there, the population a lot more complicated than left and right. I'm guessing no argument from you there.
I think that's right. I think there's a lot of validity to the idea that news media tends to boil politics down into simple sound bites, into black and white categories, and that distorts some of the richness of what's really going on in the public and in all politics, really. I would also point the finger a little bit at us, at survey researchers, and to say we're able to get at some of the depth and the complexity of the public with the kinds of questions that we ask, but other kinds of research methods can bring that out even more. Professor Kathy Kramer at Wisconsin uses interview methods to really listen to what people are saying and what they bring up themselves, and that can help to bring out the richness of politics.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Dan with us in Franksville. Dan, hi.
Yeah, it's funny. You got the same animal, the same human animal. Supposedly they have different views and different thoughts on life, which would actually have to be fraudulent. So they must be learning it from somewhere. They get it maybe from the media, which actually is a business. So it's not there to inform you it's a business, and that's their job. to sell you things and stuff that you probably don't even need. But I consider myself a conservative, but it's funny, most of my friends, I call them fake conservatives. I'm nice and everything, and it's not their fault because they have little understanding of the issues, just like so-called liberals that are supposed to be, you know, worry about liberal. I don't even know what a liberal even means, but, you know, be nice to people and all this other stuff. But they voted for Hillary Clinton, that hung around with Madeleine Albright, that was instrumental as far as Iraq.
So, Dan, thanks a lot for the call. So, Dan, Dan saying he sees in other people anyway a lot of confusion about what it means to be a liberal and or a conservative. And Nathan, he points toward an example I thought of. You get people on the left and on the right for maybe different reasons coming to agreement on, say, an isolationist or non-interventionist military policy in the United States. Given all the different issues that go into left and right, is that another reason maybe to say, eh, maybe they're not that meaningful?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways that you can, a lot of different values and principles that can lead you to agreement, and sometimes even coming from the same abstract principles, you can still wind up with differing conclusions about how we actually go from turning those abstractions into concrete and specific policy outcomes. And this caller also is picking up a similar point from the previous caller that one of the reasons why news media is simplifying is because ultimately they want to have an audience that will respond, they can sell to advertisers, and so on the one hand they have good goals of informing the public, but as journalists, but oftentimes they have a bottom line to watch, and unfortunately the public is often not willing to sit through the more detailed kinds of more nuanced representations, and that's one of the limitations that fits the broader conclusions of our book, that people tend to be less attentive to politics and less patient with more sophisticated ways of connecting political ideas.
Dan, thanks for the call. Dave is with us next in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just was listening to the conversation, and I can tell you, I'm a retired state legislator who is a Democrat, but I consider myself a liberal. Now, what does that mean? You know, I like to think of it as open-minded and think and thoughtful. But what bothers me is that today we've got too many people who throw labels around like liberal or alt-right, etc., and like they're like you're calling someone a war criminal, and that just totally warps the conversation. You know, you don't have a discussion anymore. You say, well, you're a liberal, you're a right winger, or whatever, and no one actually gets past that label to listen to what the other person is talking about.
Dave, thanks a lot thanks for the call, Dave. Nathan, we've weaponized our political labels.
Yeah, that's right. Especially partisan labels people use as political insults, and it does get in the way that the sort of tribal thinking of us versus them in a partisan context can really shut down conversations and really hide that in many cases the substance of our political views and some of our broader values might have more in common than you might think.
Thanks for the call, Dave. Briefly, as we wrap up, Nathan, are you starting to think about ways we could do this all better to get people more engaged in maybe a not less, as you say, tribal way?
Well, one of the paradoxes of all of this is that, as I alluded to earlier, we have this notion of an uncommitted but engaged citizen, and that's really, although there might be individual examples of that, it's hard to see a broader public that becomes more engaged but yet more open-minded or less attached to party or even ideology. It seems like with all of the evidence that we have from decades of surveys, it's a trade-off. You either have a public that's disengaged and relatively not ideological, or a public that is more engaged and is more committed to one side or the other.
We'll leave it there for now. Nathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking to Nathan Calmo. He's an assistant professor of political communication at Louisiana State University. He's from Wisconsin. Still a Packer fan, as he mentioned. He's co-author of the new book we've been talking about. It's called Neither Liberal Nor Conservative, ideological innocence in the American public. Still time for you to weigh in over at the Central Time Facebook page. Do you use a political label for yourself like liberal, conservative, socialist, libertarian, moderate? And what does it mean to you? That's the Central Time Facebook page.
Emmy nominations are out for the best in TV, and Wisconsin has made a good showing this year.
As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a handful of people with Wisconsin ties are in contention for some of the big awards.
Jeffrey Tambor was nominated for Best Actor in a Comedy for his role in Transparent. He's won that category twice already, and he spent 5 seasons with the Milwaukee Repertory Theater.
I've watched him a lot in Arrested Development. I had no idea about that Milwaukee connection. Also from the show Transparent, a Milwaukee Rep alum, Judith Light, nominated for Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy.
Carrie Coon is a nominee for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Limited Series or Movie for Fargo. She performed at American Players Theater and UW-Madison.
And I've seen her perform downstairs in a theater in this building. So she's one I did know about that Wisconsin connection for. She's been on Central Time, by the way.
Very cool. UW-Madison graduate Steve Levitan got another in a series of nominations as the creator of the show Modern Family, and he gave the UW-Madison commencement address in May.
And documentary filmmaker Mark Sammels of Shawano is up for a documentary award as executive producer of Oklahoma. That's an American Experience documentary. The take home here, go see some local theater, I guess, because you might be able to say, I knew them. I saw them before they were a big deal.
Yes, that's where it all starts. Local theater. Very cool. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.